Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, New York Times investigative reporter James Risen, says he would rather go to prison than reveal the name of a CIA source who leaked classified information to him for his 2006 book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. The source told Risen about a botched CIA operation to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. In 2007, James Risen was notified that the FBI and DOJ were conducting a criminal investigation. And since then, he's been in a legal battle for refusing to testify about the information he published. His message for government officials is, I'm not going away, and he's not mincing words. Earlier this year, James Risen called President Obama the, quote, greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation, end quote. In his latest book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, James Risen writes, quote, Obama performed a neat political trick. He took the national security state that had grown to such enormous size under Bush and made it his own. In the process, Obama normalized the post-9/11 measures that Bush had implemented on a haphazard emergency basis. Obama's greatest achievement, or great sin, was to make the national security state permanent, end quote. In James Risen's newest book, he writes about what he calls the national security industrial complex, government secrecy, billions of dollars of waste, corruption, greed, and a war on freedom of the press and whistleblowers. James Risen is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. He's the author of State of War and his latest, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And James Risen joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So because it's Veterans Day today, I wanted to ask you about a quote in your book when you mention war and veterans. You write that America has become accustomed to a permanent state of war. Only a small slice of society, including many poor and rural teenagers, fight and die, while a permanent national security elite rotates among senior government posts, contracting companies, think tanks, and TV commentary, opportunities that would disappear if America was suddenly at peace. To most of America, war has become not only tolerable, but profitable, and there's no longer any great incentive to end it. So what's going through your mind on Veterans Day? I mean, you just tweeted that these issues are still not really being debated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you just quoted from the book pretty much sums up my feelings and beliefs about it. I think we have had 13 years of continuous war, and it looks like it's going to continue even longer, and yet we've had very little debate about that. And meanwhile, we have had no draft. We've had a volunteer military, and so very few people are actually paying much of a cost in this war. And as a result, we can have kind of wars of choice, wars where only volunteers get involved directly, and most of the country acts like the war is not happening.
Can you give us an update on your case? You have become a prominent voice in defending freedom of the press, especially under President Obama. What is the latest?
I don't know. There's a trial scheduled for January, and that's about all I really know what's going on with it. It seems like it's up in the air. I'm kind of waiting for the government to decide what they want to do.
Have you been talking with any government officials about this? I mean, when you interview them, does this come up?
No, I try not to talk about that when I do stories.
So 60 Minutes recently did a piece on how this all happened, and it started in 2006 when you spoke to a CIA source about a botched operation to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And we've got the 60 Minutes piece on our website, and I hope you all can check it out, because New York Times editors Bill Keller and the name's escaping me, the woman who recently left,
Jill Abramson.
Thank you, Jill Abramson. They're talking about how the Bush White House worked really hard to kill the story. Can you talk a little bit?
I think they were referring to the NSA wiretapping story.
Right, right. Sorry about that. Yeah, the NSA wiretapping story, because that's what you won a Pulitzer for. And so in 2006, sorry, I was getting those two confused. Talk a little bit about how the Bush White House went after that story and put the pressure on the New York Times not to print it.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 2004, Eric Lischbau and I found out about the Bush administration's NSA domestic spying program. And we had the story ready to go in October 2004, but the Bush administration convinced the editors of the paper that it would harm national security. And so they didn't run it. And then we continued after the presidential election in November 2004, we tried again and did more reporting and tried to get it in the paper, but the editors killed it again because of the White House continued to say it would harm national security. So in 2005, I decided to put it in my book, the story in my book, State of War. And then when a few months before the book came out, I told the editors at the Times it was going to be in my book and that the Times should run the story. And finally, in December 2005, they ran a story, and my book came out about 2 weeks later.
So do you think that if you hadn't had said you were going to put it in your book, what do you think would have happened to that story?
It wouldn't have run. It was dead by that time.
How do you think that has affected the work that reporters are doing on this story? Because it was amazing in the 60 Minutes piece to hear the editors blatantly say that they were under pressure, and for that reason, they weren't going to run this story.
I think the whole experience, the very intense experience that I went through and with fighting to get that story in the paper and ultimately succeeding, I think in hindsight, it's changed the culture at the New York Times, and I think helped more broadly in journalism to break the fever that existed in the years after 9/11, where the media was too deferential to the government. And I think today things are much different at the New York Times, I know specifically, and I think throughout journalism, there's more skepticism about government claims of when they ask editors or ask news publications to not publish stories. And I think that the Times today is much much more skeptical than it was before our story. And I think it really changed the climate and the culture at the paper, I think, for the better.
Do you think that it caused reporters to be more skeptical of President Obama?
Well, I think it goes in cycles. I mean, I think one of the problems with the broader war on terror is that, you know, you keep getting new generations of reporters, new generations of public officials, because it's been going on for so long. And so people have to relearn the lessons that the people before them are. And I'm kind of an oddity in that, you know, I covered 9/11. I was there. Actually, I was covering the CIA before 9/11, and I covered 9/11, and I've covered national security off and on since then. And but most people who cover it have not been doing it for that long, and so they have to, you know, you get a new generation of people who have to learn old lessons.
You don't mince words when you talk about what's happened under the Obama administration. You write that he took the national security state that had grown to such enormous size under Bush and made it his own. In the process, Obama normalized the post-9/11 measures that Bush had implemented on a haphazard emergency basis. His great achievement, a great sin, was to make the national security state permanent. Can you talk about what you mean by that exactly?
Well, I mean, basically, Obama has taken virtually every counterterrorism operation or program or tool that Bush was using and has continued or expanded them. The one thing, you know, if you remember, right after he was elected, he said he was going to close Guantanamo, and then he didn't close it under pressure, and he caved into that pressure. And I think he began to look, I think, at a lot of the other measures that Bush had used. And really the only thing that you can point to that he has stopped was the use of torture. Pretty much everything else he has continued or expanded, from drones to military commissions to any number of activities. And he also said that he wasn't going to look back. He was going to not conduct any investigations into the past behavior of the Bush administration or the intelligence community or the military. And so he has, and he, you know, continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the things people don't remember, the critics of Obama point out that he pulled out of Iraq, but all he really did was withdraw troops at the time designated under the Status of Forces Agreement that Bush had negotiated prior to leaving office. So there's very well, it's the continuity in the war on terror between the two administrations is much greater than the differences.
Today I'm speaking with James Risen, New York Times investigative reporter, who's out with a new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. James says that he would rather go to prison than reveal the name of a CIA source who leaked classified information to him for his 2006 book, State of War. James, what I find fascinating, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is I've been watching interviews you've been doing about potential jail time and your book, and it seems like most of the people interviewing you are focusing on the jail time and not the details in your book, because you reveal so much about waste, government secrecy, greed, and corruption. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I agree with you. I'd like to talk more about my book and about my legal case, so ask me questions about my book.
All right, well, let's do that. So, I mean, you've got so many details in here. $14 billion in cash being flown to Iraq by the U.S. government. The Pentagon tried to set up its own version of the CIA, complete with foreign agents. You've got so many stories about contractors who are making so much money. Out of all of these cases, which one kind of caught you off guard? Which one do you still think about?
Well, there's a lot of them, but I think the one that is just the most shocking to me, or the actually the most, I don't know, either shocking or funny or dark humor, I don't know what to make of it, but the fact that the United States thought it was a good idea to airlift $14 billion in $100 bills to Iraq still makes me shake my head. Basically, what happened was, in the weeks and months after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Bush administration, along with the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the U.S. occupying government in Iraq, began to airlift cash from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that had been in an account which held Iraqi government oil revenue funds, and began to then would take the cash from a currency facility in New Jersey, truck it to Andrews Air Force Base, put it on pallets of $100 bills, stacks of $100 bills, and then airlift it to Baghdad International Airport, and then have it convoyed either to the Green Zone or to the Iraqi Central Bank. And once it arrived in Baghdad and was taken downtown, much of it disappeared. And for years, billions and billions of it was unaccounted for. Finally, I disclosed that the Special Inspector General for Iraq, Stuart Bowen, after years of investigating it, tracked almost $2 billion in $100 bills to a bunker in rural Lebanon, where after it was stolen in Baghdad and then moved to Lebanon by the people who stole it. But nobody in the U.S. government or in the Iraqi government showed any interest to go after it after Bowen told them about it.
And as far as you know, it's still sitting there?
It could be sitting there. It might have been moved recently. I'm not sure. After my book came out, it's possible more of it got moved. I'm sure some of it's been spent, but it's a massive amount of cash that was just sitting in a bunker because physically it was so much that it was difficult for the people who stole it to get much of it into the banking system all at once.
You write that all told, $20 billion was sent to Iraq without any clear orders or direction on how the money was to be used. You also write about certain people who were not comfortable with this, like Jed Smith. He was a veteran.
Jed Smith. Yeah, he was a really interesting guy. He was the Treasury Department. He was the head of the Treasury Department team for Iraq economic and financial reconstruction at the beginning of the war. And his team, it was a group of international reconstruction experts at the Treasury Department who, whenever there's a country that has kind of collapsed, they go and helped reconstruct their financial systems. His team was sent to Iraq right after the U.S. invasion to help restart the Iraqi central bank and financial banking system. And they created, they initially airlifted about $1.7 billion in cash from frozen Iraqi accounts to help restart the central bank and the state banks and get some currency in the system in Iraq. And then they created a new Iraqi currency, which was in place by October, I think, 2003. That post-Saddam currency, which was successful. And they were never told that the CPA and the Bush administration continued to airlift all of this other cash after they were finished and had introduced a new currency, which they thought meant that there was no need for any more cash than the small amount, the relatively small amount that they had already airlifted. And Smith said that the CPA, as far as he knows, never told the Treasury Department what they were doing and saw no reason for it. And so, you know, it was just a remarkable, yet another example of how chaotic the Bush administration's efforts in Iraq were in the post-war period.
You write that Ged Smith's Treasury team was so disgusted by all of this that they all quit. And you say that it also meant that the Treasury team just wasn't even there to stop one of the biggest acts of thievery in history. And you have just so many interesting details in the book. You write about how Ged Smith gave a talk about what would happen to people who worked for Saddam Hussein. He warned that because the Iraqi economy was so central, taking down the Iraqi government would likely mean the forced closure of hundreds of Iraqi companies and state-owned enterprises. Basically, people don't know what to do without orders from the regime. He wanted to let people know that these people are going to be out of work. Well, he looked up after he issued this dire prediction, and no one in the crowd said a word. Nobody even asked a question.
Yeah, that was at a planning meeting for post-war reconstruction at Fort McNair in Washington right before the invasion. He was trying to, there was these kind of cursory efforts by the Bush administration at post-war planning. And he was trying to warn other officials in the Bush administration that, you know, there were a lot of unintended consequences that were going to result from an invasion and a toppling of the Saddam government. And he warned them that, you know, that the Iraqi economy was highly centralized. And as a result, you know, all of these factories throughout the country would immediately shut down if the government shut down. And nobody from the Bush administration wanted to hear that or talk about it or debate it or discuss it.
James Risen is New York Times investigative reporter. We're talking about his latest book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. We are talking about some of the details in James' book about waste and corruption, what happened post 9/11. And if you have a question for James Risen about what he calls the national security industrial complex, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. James Risen says he would rather go to prison than reveal the name of a CIA source who leaked classified information to him for his 2006 book. Now, when he does interviews, most of the interview focuses on that aspect. But we found so many great nuggets in James' book, so we wanted to specifically talk about what he reveals about security post 9/11. And James, you just talked about what happened in Iraq and the $20 billion that was flown to Iraq. And you say that this is sort of a blueprint for what we saw after 9/11. You write that the U.S. intelligence budget alone has at least doubled since 2001. By 2013, it stood at more than $70 billion a year, including both civilian and military intelligence spending.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what we've created since 9/11 is a massive new national security apparatus that, because of the secrecy and classifications that surround it, it's very difficult for most Americans to understand how large it's gotten. And it's created what I believe is a kind of a new political constituency that didn't really exist before, and that is the intelligence community is now playing a much larger role in policy debates in Washington. You know, you see now, I think that the intelligence community has become so large that it's willing to take on Congress on things like whether or not the torture report should be released. And so I think what you now have that we should recognize is that 13 years of war have created a new kind of government within the government that never existed on this scale before.
Oh, we have a question about money. Let's hear from Frank in Fresno. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just, actually more of a comment. I'm reminded of Dulles' boast of flying into Tehran in the mid-50s with a suitcase full of $100 bills and changing out Mossadegh for the Shah of Iran. I remember watching the footage of the invasion of Iraq very early on in America's operation there. I believe it was footage of the airport, and somebody sitting next to me who had been watching these things for several decades more said, "Briefcases full of $100 bills disappearing." And I observed that in the contemporary context, it's more like pallets full of $100 bills disappearing.
Yeah.
And that's what your bunker story brought to my mind.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the numbers are larger. There's more zeros at the end these days.
Mm-hmm. Have you asked any Obama officials about this? Because you said that no one in the Obama administration has done anything about this.
Yeah, no, they don't want to talk about it. You know, Stuart Bowen, as I detail in the book, he was a special inspector general. He went to the CIA and the FBI and the State Department and tried to get, during the Obama administration, and tried to get them involved in going after it or doing some kind of investigation, and they all refused. He also met with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq, and Maliki expressed anger to him over the fact that the way the United States had handled the cash flights. But he also expressed knowledge of the bunker in Iraq, and but also made it clear that the Iraqi government wasn't really going to do anything about it. Bowen also was denied country clearance by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut to come to Lebanon.
And James, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. I'm speaking with New York Times reporter James Risen about his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about California's drought. A dozen communities across the state are at risk of running out of water. And according to state officials, about 700 households already lack access to running water. So what do you want to know about the drought? How will the new groundwater regulations and Proposition 1, which did pass on Election Day, impact water usage? Is your area being affected? That's tomorrow. And on Thursday, we will talk about street harassment, which is getting a lot of attention these days. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm joined by investigative reporter James Risen. He's an investigative reporter with the New York Times. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer for his stories about warrantless wiretapping. Be sure to watch the 60 Minutes piece that aired recently about what happened there and why the New York Times initially refused to run that story. James is out with a new book called Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. He says President Obama's great achievement or great sin was to make the national security state permanent. So what questions do you have about the national security state, government secrecy, waste, and corruption? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And thank you for calling in, Frank. Let's hear from Eileen in Redwood City. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, this is Andy from Redwood City.
Oh, hi, Andy. Sorry about that.
Okay, Rose. Good morning, and good morning to Mr. Risen. Mr. Risen, you're a great patriot, no question about it. I was wondering what you thought about if you saw the new Laura Poitras film, Citizen Four, and the role that Bill Binney has played, and Tom Drake, and I think it's Diane Rourke, and trying to get the word out on the great threat that the NSA is to our representative democracy and the demise of our Fourth Amendment. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Yeah, I have a whole chapter in my Pay Any Price about Diane Rourke and the other NSA whistleblowers. And in particular, I kind of provide, I think, the most thorough examination and detail about Diane Rourke's story that's come out. Diane Rourke was the House Intelligence Committee's staffer in charge of overseeing the NSA at the time of 9/11. And soon after 9/11, she found out about the NSA's domestic spying operations from, actually from Bill Binney, and who had been told about it by a contractor at the NSA. And then she began a long odyssey within the government of trying to put a stop to the program. And she went to her bosses and then to many other powerful people inside the government who she knew to try to get them to stop the program or at least warn them about the existence of the program. And everywhere she turned, she found that people who she thought would have been sympathetic to her already knew about the program and were covering it up. And then she finally had a very dramatic showdown with the director of the NSA, Michael Hayden, where she told him she thought the program was illegal, and he made it clear that he thought they could continue, and even if it leaked out, they would have the majority of nine on their side, meaning the Supreme Court would side with them even if it was if the program was disclosed. And so she then tried to get a message to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, to warn him about the existence of the program, but she never heard back from him. And then years later, after she had retired, and after our stories were came out about and disclosed the existence of the NSA program, the FBI raided her house, even though she had never leaked to the press. She wasn't one of our sources, and all she had ever done is stay within the system and try to warn people the way they government claims they want people to warn.
This is an amazing chapter in the book, James, because you say that Diane is perhaps the most courageous whistleblower of the 9/11 era, and yet I have never heard of her before. I bet a lot of people haven't. Why is that?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is that there were five people all, you know, after our stories came out in 2005 and the New York Times disclosing the existence of the warrantless wiretapping and domestic spying program, Justice Department began a criminal leak investigation to try to find out who our sources were. And in 2007, about a year and a half after our stories ran, they raided the houses of, I think, four or five of those people all in one day, including Diane Rourke. And they thought Diane Rourke was the prime suspect because she had been so vocal within the system trying to stop it, because she felt so strongly that it was unconstitutional. The other people who were caught up in it were all people who she knew from the NSA, and the only real common denominator they all had was that they had all signed a complaint to the Inspector General of the Defense Department about contractor abuse and waste at the NSA. It was unrelated to the domestic spying program. So they raided their houses with no real evidence whatsoever that they had leaked anything. And a few months later, they also raided the house of Thomas Drake, who was still active. He was the only one of those people who was still an employee at the NSA at the time. Drake, all of them were raided, and I've seen the search warrants. They all mention in the search warrants me and Eric Lischblau, that they were looking for our sources for our stories in the New York Times. And after, when they raided Drake's house, it was also part of the leak investigation into our story. Drake had nothing to do with our stories, but in the process of when his house was raided, he told the FBI, you know, I never talked to the New York Times, I only talked to the Baltimore Sun about waste and abuse, contractor abuse on an NSA program called Trailblazer. And because he said that to the FBI, they then prosecuted him for talking to the Baltimore Sun, even though the story began, the investigation began because they were looking at who our sources were. And so they basically decided to prosecute him on the leaking to the Baltimore Sun about Trailblazer because they couldn't get anybody about our stories. And so Diane Rourke and the others who were involved who were caught up in the investigation, their stories kind of got lost because Thomas Drake's prosecution went forward on the Baltimore Sun instead.
And you write that Rourke's home was invaded at 6 a.m. in Oregon on July 26, 2007. As she opened the door, at least a dozen agents filed in. The lead agent quickly asked if she had any guns, and she said no. He then showed her a search warrant. While other agents started to carry out her computer and other equipment, one female agent accompanied Rourke back upstairs, watched as she got dressed, and then followed her outside when she decided to get out of the house and work in her garden while the FBI rifled through her belongings. The search took 5 hours, conducted mostly by women wearing hairnets and gloves, and even extended to the apartment of a tenant who was renting rooms in her house. They took 15 boxes filled with her belongings, made her sign for it, and then left. Where is she today?
She still lives in Oregon. She's still retired, and she had to fight even after, you know, the FBI, the Justice Department never filed any charges against her. The whole case against her was dropped. She had to fight, and I think she still is fighting a legal battle to get some of her belongings back. They wouldn't return some of, I think it might have been her computer, I can't remember. But she, you know, she waged a long battle to try and get back all of her belongings. But she's still at home in Oregon.
You write about how she tried to contact David Addington. She had a good relationship with him. He was very close to Dick Cheney, and he never called her back. And so you say that her story really explains why Edward Snowden came out with this information. I mean, before Edward Snowden, government officials were trying to get this information out. But
yeah, I think her story shows how difficult it would have been, how impossible it would have been for Snowden to stay within the system and do what he did. She never even thought about leaking to the press. She, in fact, told Michael Hayden that she was not going to leak to the press when she met with him. And yet they considered her a threat because she wasn't willing to go along with the program. And so even though she was staying within her chain of command, staying inside the system, she was considered a threat. And then when, you know, so when our stories came out, she was their prime suspect.
Today I'm speaking with James Risen about his new book, Pay Any Price. James is an investigative journalist with the New York Times. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer for his stories about warrantless wiretapping. And if you'd like to join us, oh, we actually have full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Steve in Los Gatos. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you, Roseanne? Thank you for actually discussing the substance and the content of Mr. Risen's book and rather than his legal case. I think it's really been a shame that what he's brought to public attention hasn't been discussed for the substance that he's revealing. And Mr. Risen, thank you very much for your book. I just bought it last weekend, in fact, and I had to put it down after reading about 40 pages because I was just so repulsed by just the sheer incompetence demonstrated by the people in whom we trust our national security. And I was particularly vexed by two matters. One, this case of Dennis Montgomery.
Yeah.
And the fact that you also reveal that the Pentagon's own reporting has demonstrated that since 9/11, they've let $400 billion in contracts to firms who had previously been sanctioned for at least $1 million worth of fraud.
Right.
And this led me to... I think the reason that they're coming after you is because your reporting is simply demonstrating the extraordinary incompetence and greed that has come to seize our government by the throat.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I agree with you. I think what I think is that there's never been a single newspaper story or broadcast, anything on the media since 9/11 that's harmed national security. And that what the government tries to do when they yell about national security damage from the press, they're really trying to stop embarrassing stories or politically damaging stories rather than anything that harms national security. And I remember when I saw the report that included that statistic you just cited of 400, you know, this all that fraud that's... It just blew me away. It's just unbelievable that the Pentagon can still go back to the same people who have defrauded them in the past.
And he's right. You read your book and you think, is this really happening? So tell us about Dennis Montgomery. You write that he was the maestro behind what many current and former U.S. officials and others familiar with the case now believe was one of the most elaborate and dangerous hoaxes in American history, a ruse that was so successful that it nearly convinced the Bush administration to order fighter jets to start shooting down commercial airliners filled with passengers over the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's Dennis Montgomery is one of my favorite characters in the whole war on terror. He was a self-styled computer software expert who in 2003... He had long claimed to have super secret software technology that, among other things, could find hidden objects or hidden messages in videotape. And he tried to sell this kind of technology to Hollywood and then to the casino industry, never with any success. And then finally was able to get contracts from the U.S. military and from the CIA. Or actually work from the CIA. Finally, in 2003, the CIA became so convinced of his secret technology that they came to believe that he could read secret messages hidden in Al Jazeera news broadcasts that Al-Qaeda was sending to its agents all over the world about future attacks. And so he claimed, and the CIA believed, that he could see hidden letters and numbers in the banner on Al Jazeera videos that they brought to him. And so Al Jazeera, he was watching Al Jazeera newscasts constantly and kept coming up with numbers and letters that he would give to the CIA. And the CIA sent people out to his offices in Reno. And the CIA, by Christmas time 2003, became so convinced of this, they told President Bush that they had identified a series of flights that were coming to the United States from overseas that he had to ground because they were targets for Al-Qaeda, based on Montgomery's claim that these series of numbers and letters that he was getting from Al Jazeera, hidden inside Al Jazeera newscasts. Then finally, because a lot of the flights were from Paris, French intelligence demanded to know where the CIA was getting this information, what their super secret source was. And they finally revealed that where it was coming from, and the French kind of reverse engineered it to had a high-tech company there try and look at it. And they told them this was a hoax and a fabrication, and that there were no secret letters or numbers in these broadcasts. And French finally convinced the CIA of that. And then once the CIA realized that it had all been a fabrication, they covered the whole thing up and didn't do anything about it.
How much money did Dennis Montgomery ultimately make? How many contracts did he get?
It's a little unclear because he kept changing corporate entities. And he kept getting different sponsors to help him start companies. And so he would get contracts from different agencies in the government. But it was millions of dollars. After the CIA covered this up and dumped him, he kept getting more contracts with the military. And so he got contracts up until the Obama administration. In 2009, there's some evidence that he may have been involved with a hoax that there were Somali terrorists who were going to attack at President Obama's first inaugural in Washington, which the government took very seriously, but then realized was a hoax. So he lasted a long time and had a lot. He kept changing corporate entities, which is a little bit tricky to actually total up the amount of money he got, but it was millions of dollars.
In your next chapter, you've got a story about Neil and Lyndon Blue. You say that the global war on terror has been very, very good to them. Lyndon Blue is the vice chair of the firm, and Neil and Lyndon own the privately held General Atomics. You write, almost no one outside of the insular world of the defense industry has ever heard of the Blue Brothers, but they are the men who ultimately profit the most from America's drone war, from the use of predators and reapers, the soulless hunter-killers that circle the skies of Pakistan, Yemen, and other chaotic lands. In fact, the Blue Brothers have benefited from the decade-long homeland security binge more than almost any other Americans. In 2012, General Atomics received $1.8 billion in government contracts, up from just $110 million in 2001. Yeah, we've never, or I've never heard, no one on the team has ever heard of the Blue Brothers.
Yeah, it's, they're really interesting because they are kind of eccentric in some ways. They grew up in Colorado. They both went into the Air Force back in the 60s. They were pilots, but then they got into business and investments, and they bought this little company that kind of bounced around for years and years called General Atomics, which started out as a part of much larger corporations until they bought it. And they kind of got into, it was a company that wasn't doing drones, so they kind of bought into the drone technology, and then in the 90s started building drones that the Clinton administration was using as surveillance drones in the Balkans, which is, I think, the first place they were deployed. And then right at the time of 9/11, the military and the CIA were considering arming these Predator drones that General Atomics made. And there had not been a decision yet at the time in 9/11 about whether to go forward with the Hellfire-armed Predator. And then 9/11 accelerated that program, and it was deployed soon after 9/11 in Afghanistan, and the rest is history for the Blue Brothers. They went from being very obscure, wealthy people to extremely wealthy, powerful figures in the war on terror who controlled the most important weapon, the signature weapon of the war on terror.
You write that in 2006, the Center for Public Integrity found that this company, General Atomics, had spent more than any other company to pay for the travel of congressional staffers. How did that work?
Yeah. Well, the Blue Brothers, there had been a number of investigations of their activities, including some before 9/11. And none of them have ever gone anywhere because I think partly because they have such great power in the war on terror. One of my favorite stories about the Blue Brothers is that they first started talking about drones during Iran-Contra, and they wanted to try to use drones to attack the Sandinistas. They tried to convince the Reagan administration, or at least thought about proposing unarmed robots to fly down to Central America. And that was where they first started thinking about drone use. They're very conservative, and they have one of the brothers wrote column once describing how terrible it was that the government was providing so much money to subsidize people, without kind of irony-free statement, given the fact that his company was his defense contracts had grown tenfold during the war on terror.
James Risen is author of the book Pay Any Price. He's a New York Times investigative reporter, and we've got time for a few calls. Let's go to Ruth in Oakland. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Mr. Risen, for your incredible work. I'm a psychologist, and there's a small part of your book that is of particular interest to me. I had been a member of the American Psychological Association until starting to challenge them with a bunch of other psychologists over their policies, over their changes in the ethics code and their policies towards psychologists working at Guantanamo. And your book is the first presentation of actual kind of smoking gun evidence of something that I'd suspected for now 5, 6, 7 years, that there has been actual CIA collaboration with the staff of the American Psychological Association, including the director of ethics. And I wondered if you, this is something that I think very few people know about. It's just a small part of your book, but I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. There's a, in my chapter on torture called The War on Decency, I have a section about a man named Scott Gerwehr, who is a really interesting character, who was a researcher, a behavioral science researcher at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, and then at the Defense Group, which is a defense contractor. He died in 2008, and I was able to, but he had had a long relationship with the CIA. I was able to get his computer, which revealed all of his, which included all of his emails for many years. And the email cache from Scott Gerwehr revealed a number of connections between behavioral science scientists, professional psychologists, and the agencies involved with the harsh interrogation programs of the Bush administration. And there's also a number of emails that I document in the book that describe the relationship between behavioral scientists from the CIA, the Pentagon, and other intelligence and military agencies and the American Psychological Association, and how after Abu Ghraib and after that scandal erupted, the APA worked closely with psychologists and behavioral scientists from the CIA and the government to try to shape how the APA would respond and deal with the role of psychologists involved in interrogations.
Well, thank you for the call. And unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but I have one quick email for you, James. Marianne says, at the Palo Alto Library, 4 copies of James' book are on order. 17 people are in line who've requested the book.
Yes, I like that.
So people are reading the book and they're getting these details. But again, it is pretty striking that in a lot of the interviews you've been doing, you're just not being asked about the details. It's mostly, will you reveal your source? Are you going to jail? So what can be done about what you call this permanent national security state when a lot of these details are not really being exposed?
Well, I guess I got to talk to more people like you who are willing to talk about it. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking about it. I mean, to anybody who wants to buy the book, I'm around.
Books, any place.
Well, we've got a couple emails about, you know, the political system, voting for the lesser of two evils. What do you think people can do about this? I mean, you say again that Obama has created a national security state, and it's permanent now. So what can be done about this?
I think the biggest thing that Americans have to do is stop panicking every time, panicking and engaging in fear-mongering about terrorism. I think until the American people become more skeptical about terrorism, the government and politicians are going to continue to do this because they believe that it works politically. It's really up to the American people to stop being so scared. And I think that's the only time the politicians will take the cue to become more skeptical about it.
And what are you working on right now?
I just did a story yesterday, actually Sunday, about another crazy operation in the U.S. government involving a New York Port Authority detective who was engaged in kind of an intelligence operation with a terrorist group in Iran, which was kind of crazy. So I try to look for stories to write for the paper that are kind of off, that nobody else is looking into. So that's kind of what I try to do nowadays, is look for stories that nobody else knows about.
Well, we'd love to have you back, and thank you so much for exposing all of these stories. James Risen is an investigative reporter with the New York Times. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer for his stories about warrantless wiretapping. He's the author of State of War and his latest Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are California communities dealing with the drought? On the next Your Call, we're discussing the current state of the drought. A dozen communities across the state are at risk of running out of water, and at least 700 households already lack access to running water. Farmers have left nearly 500,000 acres of land unplanted. So how will new groundwater regulations and Prop 1 impact water usage? What do you want to know about the drought, and is it affecting your area? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.